Welcome, y'all, to the Direct Examination Podcast. I'm Amber Fulmer.
I'm Dane Phillips.
And I'm Joseph Bias. Welcome, everybody who may be a new listener, individuals who've joined us before. We thank you so much for your click, for your listen, for your download. If you haven't already, go wherever you got this podcast. Give us a 5-star review. We really appreciate it. And if you have any questions for us, any suggested guests, send us an email at directexaminationpodcast@gmail.com. Dane, Amber, how are y'all?
Well, how are you?
Well, look, that's the real question. The married man.
Exactly.
You tell us.
You look refreshed, what? Joseph.
And for, obviously, it's an audio podcast. Everyone can't see, but my COVID beard is gone. It is now at normal levels. My now wife made me grow it out for the wedding, but now that it's over, I've been allowed to cut it. I was in the doghouse for half of a day for cutting it, but that was our first married disagreement in the grand scheme of things. It's not a big one.
You still have the NBA Jam console at the house, so I mean, you haven't lost all respect yet.
I haven't lost all respect. Yeah. I appreciate that, and there are a lot more flowers and girly things and candles in the house, so I'm still losing, but I have some respectability.
Eventually, everything will be phased out.
That's right.
It's so funny how you think you have control.
No,
even a little bit.
No, I do not. But, you know, speaking of control, we have nothing but illustrious guests on the podcast. And today we have an individual who has newly the control of the law school. Amber, why don't you tell us about
it? Thank you. Our guest today is the new dean of the University of South Carolina School of Law, a position he took over on August 1st of this year. Prior to joining the law school in this capacity, he was a partner with Nelson Mullins in Columbia, South Carolina. Dean Hubbard has previously served as the president of the American Bar Association from 2014 to 2015, past president of both the American Bar Endowment and the American Bar Foundation, and current chair of the board of directors of the World Justice Project. A longtime supporter of the university, he has served as a member of its board of trustees since 1986 and as a chair from 1996 to 2000. Hubbard received the Order of the Palmetto in 2002, the state's highest civilian recognition awarded for service to the state of South Carolina. So welcome, Dean William Hubbard, to the show.
Thank you, Amber.
So let's start with this transition from private practice to academia. At some point, you had to decide, well, this is something you wanted to do. That you obviously had a significant interaction with the university before then. Can you talk to us a little bit about what went into your thought process to want to take this position at the law school?
Well, thank you very much, Joseph. It was good timing for me. I was winding down some litigation that had basically consumed me for the last 3.5 years. And it was an opportunity. Some people talked to me about throwing my hat in the ring for the position, and I sort of did a little assessment. Where can I have the greatest impact on the remaining years of my professional life? Would it be repeating the same process I'd been involved in as a trial lawyer and litigator for 40 years? Or maybe I could have an impact on helping to develop and guide the next generation of lawyers and leaders for South Carolina. And to me, it was an easy decision that this is an opportunity where I think I can do more good and have a greater impact. I just really welcomed it. I'd always liked being a mentor to young lawyers in the law firm and not even in my own law firm. I like being around young people and helping them talk through their issues and concerns and, you know, what their professional aspirations are and how they might achieve their goals and dreams. So to be able to work in an environment where you have over 600 law students and to be able to offer a little bit of wisdom and guidance and support for them is a very gratifying opportunity and one that I really cherish.
The flagship law school of the state being just I know Professor Fox made a statement whenever I was in her class. And as we discussed before we started the podcast, you're dealing with all USC law alums. So the school is near and dear to our heart, that she said it's just a important thing that's unique about a state school, a flagship school, where you have the alumni have such a positive and significant influence throughout the state. You know, she has her, I saw she even posted on social media not the other day of one of her former students who just got elected to a political position, and just that great impact that our law school has in South Carolina that, say, in other states that have numerous law schools and the population's obviously much more dense, just doesn't have that same quite of an impact as a two law school state. I mean, so certainly being at the helm of that, what are the ways that you feel we can really kind of grassroots improve the alumni relations, bringing them back to the law school to kind of make it to that next level?
Dane, thank you. That's a really good question, and one that I believe is part of the reason that I'm here, is to help reconnect and, build on what Rob Wilcox has already done. He was a fantastic dean for the law school and really put some programs in place and some systems in place that I'm able to build on his foundation. But one thing we're trying to really do is as you suggest, which is get much closer to our alumni base. And I think the focus here is to give the alumni more information more frequently. Since I've been dean, I think we've already sent out five lengthy emails and with attachments about programs here, our faculty scholarship, what our students are doing with mock trial competition, the quality of the first year class, our diversity initiatives. We're trying to make sure that our alumni know what's going on in the building. I know that when I got here to be dean, I was pleasantly surprised, but in fact surprised to learn about all the different programs, all the expertise we have here, some of the specialists of our different faculty members, the books they're writing, like Seth Stoughton's book on best policing practices came out about 4 months ago. Tommy Crocker just published a book on the limits of executive power in times of crisis, another very timely topic. Derek Black is...
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
A little timely.
And the policing practices book literally came out the day before George Floyd was murdered.
Wow.
So, you know, that kind of expertise is in this building. We've had another book, Derek Black, in September, a book on the funding of public education. He takes back the history of that funding back to post-Reconstruction days and shows the discriminatory effect of a number of the ways that we fund public education, how some of those antecedent roots of discrimination continue to permeate our funding of public education in the country. And then next year, Joe Siner has a book coming out from the Cambridge University Press on the virtual workplace. So, you know, there are serious scholarship here and very timely topics. And to get back to the original question, my job is to help shine the light on some of these accomplishments and what is being produced, the scholarship, the research, the quality of teaching, to let more people know, let our alumni know, and even broader than that thing, people all over the country, what's being done at this law school. We actually sent out an email this week that we spent a lot of time trying to make sure it wasn't a word wall. It was a very informative piece about the scholarships being produced here, the number of law review articles that have been produced, that have been written, that have been placed in top 10 law reviews over the last 2 years. I mean, we're really penetrating on a national level some of the best, the law reviews and our books are really starting to get a name for ourselves. Once we sent that piece out to law deans around the country, I've gotten a number of comments back from some deans that started out their response with, wow, !! And others saying, you really have it going there in South Carolina law. So that's what we're trying to do with our alumni and with a broader audience around the country.
Dean Hubbard, one thing you just mentioned in your previous answer were some of the programs and scholarships you learned about when you got to the helm of USC. I don't know if you know, but two of us, Joseph and I, were members of the mock trial bar when we were in law school, and Dane was a member of Moot Court. And you mentioned how we grow those programs. I know since Joseph and I have been there, our former law mock trial partner, Brett Bain, is now at the helm. Y'all got some great national rankings, and I know Moot Court's doing well too. So what are some things that the law school is doing or plans on doing to get behind those programs to keep us in those national rankings? I believe our mock trial was 13 in the country at one time, even lower than that. Yeah.
Amber, I'm sorry to talk over you. The last 2 years, we've been ranked fourth in the nation.
Yeah.
So we're very proud. They're in the middle of competition now for this semester. Brett Bain is a fabulous coach. He really has the team running on all cylinders. We're very proud of that. And the Moot Court program as well. I mean, these are things that I think really distinguish South Carolina law from other law schools. We still emphasize the trial advocacy work, experiential learning, provide those opportunities, and our best students go to those programs and work in those programs and have brought us significant national acclaim. And we'll continue to focus on oral advocacy, which in many ways, if you look around the country, a lot of law schools is almost a lost art. In practice even. And so having our graduates come out and be able to stand on their feet and communicate effectively, I think is going to give our graduates a real leg up going forward.
Dean, far be it from us to question your decision-making, but you did decide to take over this job during the middle of a national pandemic. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that transition is going and what USC is doing to make sure that it doesn't, that the pandemic and situation going on in the nation doesn't impact the education that our law students receive at USC?
Yeah, I tip my hat to Rob Wilcox and the team that was in place before I got here. They worked very hard in the spring and over the summer to put programs and protocols in place that would ensure that in our in-person classes, the students were socially distanced, the masking regimen, even the sides of the hall that you're required to walk on, down to the cleaning protocols. How often the rooms are cleaned. Y'all will really appreciate this. One way we've worked on this to avoid more personal contact than is necessary. The 1L students now have home rooms, just like would they be back in high school or middle school.
Wait, what?
Home rooms. So the students come in, the 1Ls come in the morning, and they go to a room. And instead of changing rooms during the day, they stay in that room socially distanced, and the professors come to that room. And that avoids all that shifting and milling around in the hallways that
that's
you
kind
would
of genius.
Have. So that's an example of one thing that we've done. And I also have to take my hat off to the students themselves. And we had a student town hall tonight. And I congratulated them. We've had fewer than 5 positive COVID tests this semester. And that means we have serious students who are observing all the protocols and doing everything they can to get through this semester as well as they possibly can. So it's just a matter of the protocols are in place, and the building itself, we're very fortunate to have a new building that has a wonderful air circulation system. So we're pumping in fresh air all the time. It's worked out very well. Knock on wood. And another thing, the universities, rejiggered the schedule. So once the students are off for Thanksgiving, other than to coming back in the building for study and trying to find a quiet place where they can really prepare for their exams and take their exams if they want to be sure that they don't have an internet failure at home or in their apartments, they won't be coming back for classes. And if we can just get through this exam period without a spike, even around us, there's a surge in cases, we will have gotten through the semester in good form. And I think if you surveyed our students, I think they would tell you that under the circumstances, they feel very good about the education they've got.
Dean Hubbard, there's a topic I want to address that kind of really happened when we were getting ready to graduate, or at least for Joseph and I in 2010, the school's ranking. everybody makes a big deal about this U.S. News ranking and how that affects the law school. I can tell you, me personally, I don't really care about it, but I'm a South Carolina lawyer born and raised. I'm not going anywhere. I know that it is a ripple effect, and the law school ranking does matter. With that, and thank God, you know, I know one of the big factors is LSAT score, et cetera. We have this new $70 million building that's top. I mean, obviously, it's the best that is essentially in the – I wouldn't imagine there's another law school in the country that rivals our new building.
And we're very bitter that we didn't get to go to it, by the way, all three of us.
Right. We missed out on the new law school. But, you know, such a big deal was made right at that – between our 2 and 3 L year where we kind of had that slip in the rankings. And I just wanted to get your opinion on what the rankings mean, what your thoughts and kind of feelings, how you feel it moves the needle or whether we're moving, you know, the focus is to move the needle to put us in the top 50, et cetera.
The rankings do matter. They matter in terms of who applies to your law school. They matter in the kind of faculty you can recruit to your law school. You know, we're in a battle now. We're trying to recruit a couple of new faculty members, and you know, you do have to compete with schools that are ranked higher in U.S. News and World Report. We get it. There's a lot. There are many flaws in that whole calculus that U.S. News and World Report does not reward efficiencies and those kinds of things. But I'm not going to get into all of that now. We'd spend the next hour talking about algorithms and how calculations are made. But let me say this. If you look at the objective criteria of this law school, we should be ranked about 20 places higher than where we're currently ranked. Where we have seen our rankings suffer and what's brought us down is the subjective reputation of the law school. So what our challenge is to get the word out, like getting out to the voters Monday, the piece that we got out to them about our faculty scholarship. Those kinds of communications are the key to raising our subjective reputation. Now, there's another factor here, I won't get too much in the weeds because I know we have other things to cover. Each law school can name 10 alumni whom we want to evaluate our law schools. And hopefully the 10 that we name will give us good marks. We think they will because they had good experiences here. But if each school, so there are thousands of these people out there grading, and if they don't know about you, they don't grade you. Or, frankly, if you're in the South, you're probably going to not get as high grades as some of the schools up North. And so it's a... One thing that we've done this year is the Southeastern Conference deans have gotten together, and we're sharing information to our 10 about the other schools in the Southeastern Conference and vice versa. And so we hope that allows more voters in the South to vote for not just their own law school, but other law schools that are part of the Southeastern Conference. So we'll have more voters weighing in, and hopefully that'll help the reputational piece. So it's there's an art and a science to this, and what we're trying to do is really emphasize trying to make a difference by educating more people about the quality of this law school. It's not the objective criteria so much as it is the reputational piece and the subjective reputation, and we're working very hard on that, and I think you'll see those numbers move for us in the coming evaluation. And also, getting back to the LSAT score, this class, the LSAT, the just matriculated, the LSAT score has gone up and the GPA has gone up. And I have every reason to believe that the class that will come in this coming fall will even exceed those numbers. So we expect on the objective side improvement as well that will help us. One thing that will help us, and I was kidding with you guys before about sending in your money, they also judge the percentage of alumni who give back. And so even if people can give $50 or $100, that makes a difference as we give the percentages of alumni who support the law school, because that's a statement about the alumni's perception of the education they got and the quality of the education. It's a reflection of that.
And we discussed in a prior episode, I mean, as a testament to our law school and the education and value it provides, we've had some nationally known lawyers, I mean, yourself included. Our law school has bred a lot of lawyers who've had national influence. We were in a discussion in a recent episode where I brought up Judy Clark and David Bruck, who are internationally known death penalty lawyers. Our law school has just bred some great trial advocates. When you talked about earlier, the advocacy part of being a focus for our school. And I think, you know, that's one of those unknown gems that we have at the law school, is that we do breed some great lawyers. And thank God LSAT score doesn't really have the great bearing on how good of a lawyer you are, because obviously I probably wouldn't be where I am today if that was the case. But, you know, as far as that's concerned, wanted to kind of move it in another direction. I ran into a graduate of the law school, somebody who just graduated and became a lawyer, and she brought up something she wanted me to ask, and I'll leave it anonymous. I said I'd say it's an anonymous student had a question about financial aid, that the law school doesn't have its own financial aid office, and that the overall scholarships that student felt was limited. And this was a student from previous year. So I told that student I'd ask that question. So before I forgot, I wanted to go ahead and present that to you.
Yeah, I've set a goal to double our goal for the Law Carolina Fund. And those are the funds that go to the scholarships. We also, of course, welcome donations to people who want to fund endowed scholarships. But you have to give such a big amount of money for the income of that to make a difference in the amount of scholarships that you offer. So we really are working, again, I've told our development people, we have to double the amount we raise through our annual fund, because those dollars, every new dollar we raise in the annual fund, I'm allocating to scholarships for students. What we've seen in the past, and it gets back to the competition, schools have been able to offer students in South Carolina more money so that they can go out of state cheaper than they could go in state here. I think it's the fundamental challenge of University of South Carolina School of Law is to raise more money for scholarships to make sure that the best and the brightest of our state don't go out of state. And we're making progress there. We're really working on the alumni giving. We're really working on allocating any new dollars through our annual giving program to the scholarship funds. And we also want to increase funds for those students currently who are committed to public service work, be public defenders or work for the government or be prosecutors, who may be coming out of law school with a lot of debt. We want to give them scholarships as well so that they can come out with less debt and be free to choose their dream job in the public sector.
Dean Hubbard, what are some things, and I think these might be 2L courses or 3L courses, that the law school is doing to kind of expand the practice areas? We have the clinics. I think there's a discovery class or two. Are there things that the law school is looking at expanding in those areas to give the students more hands-on approach? So, like you said, with the mock trial and the moot court, we've got students ready to come out. They're on their feet. Students that know how maybe to take a deposition, serve discovery, do a mediation, those types of things.
Amber, law is no different from anything else that we're experiencing in the world around us. It is becoming very technology-based. And discovery, we all talk about e-discovery. Those algorithms and the coding of documents how you code documents to respond to discovery requests and subpoenas and those kinds of things are critical. Just file maintenance requires a lot of knowledge about technology. And we're having very intense discussions as we speak about creating a concentration on law and technology to add to the courses that we would be offering to bring more expertise into the law school to make sure our students graduate with the skill sets to compete with any lawyers in the country, whether they be in big firms or small firms, because they know they have the skills and the knowledge of technology to utilize technology to the advantage of their practices and their clients. So that's we have a children's law concentration now, and I hope by next year we'll have a law and technology concentration. We're also looking at some non-JD programs for post-JDs, or really our target audience would be students who graduate with a four-year degree who don't want to go to law school but want to get into sort of law-related fields. So we're very likely to start a non-JD program on healthcare compliance, using the expertise at the law school to train people to come in with their four-year degree. And I think law firms would hire them, hospitals would hire them, doctor's offices, insurance companies, and we'll likely have something called a master's in healthcare systems, which is a little more intense than the certificate program, but allow people to really have the training on the legal aspects of medicine and all the regulations that affect the delivery of healthcare in the United States. And we think the law school can add value to those opportunities and create new opportunities for the law school to reach a broader audience.
Dean, I'm actually a adjunct professor of one of the capstone courses, which I'll teach next spring, and I do the civil litigation capstone. And one of the conversations that not only that we've had on this podcast, but we've had in classes and with guests on the show is, you know, kind of looking at the traditional law school curriculum. You know, we've done it the same way. It seems to be forever. You go to law school 3 years, and then once you graduate, everyone's kind of on their own to find a gig. Is there any thought to maybe mixing that up other than the ways that you've said? In other words, you know, our doctor counterparts spend their last year or spend this time in rotations. And it seems like, to go off of what Amber says, you know, there's definitely a need and a desire to want to get that practical experience, and for nothing else than to be able to rule out things that you don't want to do when you get out in the profession. Is there any conversation as to looking at that and maybe ramping up those, what USC already does to go to the next level and have those type of rotations, if that makes sense?
Yeah, we have a clinics program with 8 clinics, and that provides a lot of experiential learning to our students. And our clinics program is ranked in the top 20 in the country. So we're very proud of what we do on the experiential learning front and the capstone program that you mentioned. Yes, I would like to add some more courses, especially in the e-discovery sort of arena, project management. I think you touch on things like in the capstone course, but different speakers come in for a couple of hours, and then we don't really get into as much depth because we cover such a broad landscape. But, you know, I think we could take components of the capstone program and offer, you know, more depth in those subject areas. But I think, you know, teaching lawyers case management, project management, and technology, you know, the rules of professional conduct now require that lawyers stay up to date on the latest technology. So it's an ethical obligation now. And we think we can provide that kind of education as well as anyone to our graduates and our students.
Now, I've heard a rumor talking about clinics. Now, I've been involved in some innocence cases, and the rumor I've heard is that you're interested in or have thought of possibly adding an innocence clinic. Now, Joseph and I, back in law school, were in the criminal practice clinic.
I was too.
Yeah, with Professor Gaines, and we were in it at the same time. And so clinics, you know, and my mentor, John Delgado, let's just say, you know, he's all about hands-on experience. And so I'm all for clinics. Could you elaborate whether there's going to be an innocence clinic? Because that's just something, that's a dying question of mine that I've wanted to ask you. And I've almost sent you an email twice before we even had the podcast just to ask. So,
well Dane, when I was being interviewed for this position, I was asked the question, would the law school be supportive of affiliating or supporting an innocence project? And I said, why would we not? Why would we not be working with a project whose goal is to get people who are innocent out of jail? It seems like a no-brainer to me. I don't think it's controversial. There are a lot of people who have been incarcerated. I watched the Central Park Five last night, and there's going to be a program on that Nickelodeon is sponsoring tomorrow night, and I'm moderating that program. I don't know exactly what the details of a relationship would be, whether it would be located here, where we would be partnering with other entities, but I am wide open to exploring the next steps on having some affiliation with the Innocence Project.
Dean, you mentioned in one of your opening remarks, you talked about diversity. Obviously, that's something that's near to my heart. Can you talk a little bit about what your vision is for the diversity initiatives at the school, and where would you like to see the student body of USC Law School going forward?
Let me back up from that just a little bit, Joseph. One aspect, if you look at the World Justice Project, we have a definition of what is the rule of law. And there are four universal principles. And I've been involved with that World Justice Project since its inception. And we vetted that definition with leaders from over 100 countries and scholars from all over the world. And the fourth principle talks about the independence of the judiciary, and the judiciary and the legal profession reflecting the communities they serve. And you really, so much of the rule of law and society rest on trust in the system, that the system works and it's just and it's fair. And so if we're not creating the leaders for tomorrow, the lawyers for tomorrow, the judges for tomorrow who reflect the communities, reflect our state, then we're not upholding the rule of law. To me, it's a fundamental question. It's a diversity question. It's an inclusion question. It's an equity question, but it's also fundamentally a rule of law issue. If we're going to have rule of law, if we're going to have a system that people believe in, trust, and rely on, our legal system has to reflect the communities that the legal system serves. So we have programs in place. Dean Kuo has been our assistant dean for diversity and inclusion. We're renaming that diversity, equity, and inclusion. She's taken over full time as associate dean for academic affairs. So tomorrow I will be posting an opening for an assistant dean for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we've added students to our diversity, equity, and inclusion faculty committee this year. So we're trying to jumpstart, be more aggressive about our diversity, our recruitment of students and faculty. I think you'll see some changes in the composition of our faculty in the short term that reflect that effort.
That was going to be my next question, but I appreciate you touching on it.
I'll steal one of Joseph's questions here. So yeah. Joseph's got a great question. You know, by the time you retire and you've hopefully seen your mission to conclusion your mission completed, what's the weirdest or craziest idea you have? What's that goal that's kind of that moonshot that you hope to accomplish during your tenure as dean of the law school?
So I've already mentioned one thing. I think we will have, at the conclusion of my term, I hope that we have some non-JD programs that expand the opportunities for people to learn from the experts here at this law school. And in response to the last question Joseph asked, I believe and expect we will have a more diverse faculty and a more diverse student body. I believe that we will have significantly improved our national ranking. I believe that we will have a larger endowment. We'll have more scholarship money. We'll have more chaired professorships. I believe we will have more course offerings, especially in areas like law and technology. It's a goal, and I believe we'll increase our externship opportunities, getting back to those practical skills that you're talking about, to the extent that our students can serve in corporations or law firms or businesses around the state. Those kind of externship opportunities are there. Our students have been so well received through that externship program, and they get credit for it. And they're learning a lot from very good leaders around the state, so we want to expand that. We're in the midst of setting up a new center on constitutional law, and part of the mission of that center will be to train teachers on teaching government and constitutional law to teachers around the state. It's a sad thing when you think about one-third of Americans cannot name a single branch of government. And I don't know how we can survive as a country if the electorate is so uninformed about the structure of government, the limitations on government, their rights, and their responsibilities as citizens. So I think that would perform a vital public service if we can get that off the ground. One thing that's underway right now, we bought the church across the street, or the Ed Foundation has, and we're refurbishing the church across Pickens Street into the Children's Law Center. And that'll be the new training area. We're already training 12,000 social workers, teachers, law enforcement officials, judges, and lawyers, child abuse and neglect issues, how to identify a crime. And part of this new facility will be a mock crime scene. And it'll be varied from day to day, but so that social workers could come in and there'll be evidence planted and see if they can detect where the evidence of child abuse and neglect is, and then train them on how to preserve that evidence, who to contact, how to get the evidence preserved, and then how to testify at trial so that people abusing and neglecting children don't escape the justice system. So that's something that's underway, and I hope we can accomplish that soon. Going back to Seth Stoughton and the policing, we believe we're on the cusp of having some leadership training programs for police that we would offer as a public service to South Carolina. And we see that as another ancillary activity for the law school. We haven't mentioned the Rule of Law Collaborative. We're getting grants to go in and train leaders on the rule of law in countries in Africa and all around the world, getting federal government grants from the State Department and other places through our Rule of Law Collaborative. So I think our impact on creating a stronger world, more dedicated to the rule of law, part of that starts right here at this law school with the expertise that Joel Samuels has assembled through the Rule of Law Collaborative. We're in discussions currently with a former U.S. Supreme Court clerk on having a course on U.S. Supreme Court practice from the filing of the first petition for cert all the way through the briefing, through oral arguments, and how the decisions are made and how the opinions are written. And I think we'll be able to offer that to our students next year. And then on the moonshot piece, a number of our students are really, you know, have participated in the Maymester to go over and study at Gray's Inn with Professor McWilliams and learn more about the English legal system. But I think we can expand that to other countries and provide a greater menu of opportunities if we can partner with law schools in other countries. Once we get past COVID and past a number of the travel restrictions, I'd like to have some arrangements in place where we could have student exchanges for a semester. Bring students from other countries here, and our students can benefit from what they know, what's going on in their countries, how they experience the rule of law. And then our students could go learn about just the judicial systems and laws in other countries. So that's,
you know, Dean, if you need some people to go out for like pilot programs, if you need some alumni, just go test the waters. You know, I know some folks, you know what I mean? I know some people who may be interested.
I was going to say a chaperone.
Yeah, exactly.
You three are on the top of my list.
I appreciate it.
Perfect.
Ambassadors. Perfect. Law school ambassadors.
We'll go ahead and claim that title. We're the law school ambassadors.
Dean Hubbard, one thing we asked all of our guests, I think a season ago, and we've switched as we have gone along, is war stories. And because you are a dean, you did private practice, and now you're running our flagship law school, we'll give you two. So what are your best war stories? Anything that stands out to you from your years as a private practitioner and as your time as dean?
Well, there are a lot of stories out there, but I'll just focus on one because I know we're probably out of time. But, well, I can think of 10. I don't know where to get started on this. Let's stick with one because there was a time about 25 years ago I was one of the lawyers representing Toyota Motor Sales. In disputes against the dealers were suing Toyota over the allocation of cars and whether they were getting the cars that could sell or didn't sell. And it was litigation all over the Southeast and from Louisiana down through Florida. And we had one case in Alabama. And Judge Joel Laird, I'll never forget his name, ordered that the CEO of Toyota and the CEO of Southeastern Toyota Distributors come to Anniston, Alabama for a pretrial conference. The Lear jets came into the Anniston airport. I think they had to extend the runway. And they landed at about the same time. And the noses of those two jets touched on the runway. And so the hearing, the courthouse was under renovation. And so they had moved the courthouse to the county jail. So my Japanese client, I picked him up, got in the car, and we started driving to the hearing, and he saw that concertina wire and he saw guard houses. He said, "I don't know about this American justice system." A pretrial conference. And, you know, I had to explain to him that it was temporary quarters. We wouldn't be actually in the jail with the people. It was just on the jail property. But that was an experience.
Welcome to America, right?
A little something lost in the translation there. Very little English capability, and I had to really explain he was not going to jail just because he was involved in a civil lawsuit.
Well, Dean Heber, we certainly appreciate your time with us, and for those of you listening, go check out all of those books that he mentioned by the USC professors. Check out those law school or those law review articles. You know, I think I'll speak for my co-host. We're excited about the direction of the law school, and we're appreciative of your efforts. And, you know, during these efforts, if one of your initiatives ends up being like a podcast studio for a legal podcast, well, that'll be fine. We'll accept that. But we appreciate your time. You can, of course, find out more about the law school at their website. And if you have any questions for us, you can follow us at SC Law Pod on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow me at Joseph P. Bios. You can follow Dane at SC Crim Lawyer. And Dean Herbert, you'll love this. You can follow Amber at Red Judicata, because she's our resident redhead.
I'll never forget that. Red Judicata.
I wish I could claim ownership for the cleverness, but I can't.
Wasn't that Brett?
Brett Bain came up with that for me.
Well, I wanted to jump in. And again, not just those. We have two of the professors, Professor Miller and Professor Black, who we've interviewed on this podcast. So go check out their episodes. Both of those are just outstanding episodes. And we just need to get Professor Stoughton in here so we can talk about police practices.
That's right.
He'll be glad to do it. He's one of the top two or three experts on police practicing in America.
Anybody that's been on The Daily Show is good enough for the Direct Examination podcast.
Yeah.
But again, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for all that you do. And thank you all for listening. And we will see you next time on the Direct Examination podcast.